Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week you'll hear details about this year's Stern Grove Festival, starting this Sunday, from new executive director Bob Fiedler and director of programming Judy Sang. James Sofranco talks about the second season of SF Danceworks, more from the Frameline Film Festival. And Peter Robinson talks with Shakespeare scholar Philippa Kelly about Cal Shakes and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and Shakespeare in general. Stay with us. Well, now in its second season, SF Danceworks has announced details for this year's program this weekend, co-presented by ODC Theater. The U.S. premiere of British choreographer Christopher Bruce's Shadows and a newly commissioned work by Izzy Award-winning dancemaker James Graham are highlighting the season. SF Danceworks was founded by James Sofranco, who also acts as its artistic director. James is known in the Bay Area as a soloist dancer with the San Francisco Ballet, a company he's been with for just shy of 18 years. He's also a choreographer, co-founder of the annual cancer benefit Dance for a Reason. James was also featured in the lead role of Eddie in the national tour of Twyla Tharp's and Billy Joel's Broadway musical Movin' Out. And as a choreographer, James has created many original works, including pieces for Long Beach Ballet, Marin Dance Theater, Contra Costa Ballet, and the San Francisco Ballet School Trainee Program. James, a pleasure to welcome you back to Open Air.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, there are so many wonderful dance companies here in the Bay Area that are just thriving with audiences that are just eating it all up. What is distinguishing SF Danceworks from the crowd?
It's true. There is a lot of great dance in San Francisco. It's a great dance city. And I founded SF Danceworks as a repertory company, a contemporary repertory company. There were some companies around the country that would come and tour here, such as Netherlands Dance Theater and Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, companies that I loved and have always enjoyed seeing them. And they would come every couple of years or so, and I was sad to see them go. And I always wanted to have a permanent resident company here that we can see great works of contemporary dance from the past, the present, and the future. And not just a single choreographer's vision, but a variety of styles, a variety of choreographers. So I felt there was a place for a company like this where I can show everything that I think great contemporary dance can be.
Nice. So your continued work with the SF Ballet, is that providing a pool of potential future SF Danceworks personnel, or are you finding a lot of those folks are specifically just in the ballet world?
There was a time maybe in a previous generation where the ballet and the modern worlds were more separate. And I think today those worlds are becoming more hybridized and more blended. And so it's true. A lot of my dancers this year have backgrounds in ballet companies, including San Francisco Ballet. One guy in particular, Pascal Molat, was a principal dancer for many years. He's doing a solo by Jose Limon in my program coming up. So I think many times ballet dancers have done ballet their whole life, and they get a taste of it because there's a lot of modern and contemporary choreographers coming into ballet companies, into ballet companies reps now. But it's still primarily a ballet company with ballet technique and point shoes and all that, which is great. But I think sometimes people want a little more, and they want to explore more about what their bodies can do, more about what dance can be. And this company is a great place to do that.
That's nice. And ODC seems to be your home for SF Danceworks, yes?
Yeah, for the past 2 years, they've co-presented my my season, which is spectacular. They're a great organization in the community. They have a great dance company themselves. They have a great commons where they have open classes and have over, I don't know, hundreds of classes and students coming in and out of there every day. And their theater's great. It's a nice, intimate space, not too small, not too big. I've picked some pieces this year that I think work really well in the space. And it's a great chance to see dance up close and personal, but there's still elements of theatricality there too. So it's not like you're sitting in a studio, you know, it's a great little theater.
Nice. I was pleased to read, as you mentioned, that José Limón's returning to perform his Chacon with live accompaniment from none other than violinist René Mandel, who we know so well with his other hat on as that of executive director of the Berklee Symphony.
Yes, I've known René for many, many years, and I approached him about playing this piece live. This is the piece that Pascal Molat will dance. Limón choreographed. He did dance it himself back when he created it in 1942. So this is the oldest work on the program.
Wow, neat.
So René was really eager to play it. He said it's one of the great pieces of the classical violinist repertoire, and they studied it in school, but he'd never performed it live. So he was really excited to get this chance. And of course, he and Pascal know each other. The piece is about kind of a relationship between the violin and the dancer, between the music and the choreography, and they really play off that, and you can feel that on stage because the violinist is standing right on stage with Pascal.
So a solo dancer with solo violinist.
Exactly.
Nice. The program also includes choreography inspired by the paintings of Edward Hopper. Tell us a little bit about Penny Saunders' Soir Bleu.
Soir Bleu, yes. She was inspired by a lot of the paintings of Edward Hopper, like you said. There was a Soir Bleu, it was Nighthawks, was hanging above her kitchen sink for years. And so she was doing dishes for years looking at this painting and thinking about the people in it and the just what they might be thinking about. And she looked at other paintings of his too, and kind of had this sense that the people in it had something happen to them right before, or something was about to happen to them right after these moments that were captured in the paintings. So she kind of went with that theme and took some of her scenic elements for the piece from his paintings too. We have a big mirror wall in the back of the stage, as well as a hanging window frame and a drape. So we've got a lot of production elements in this too. The other inspiration that she took was from Edward Hopper's real life story, his relationship with his wife, who was a painter too, but kind of gave up her career for his. She was playing with all these ideas, images from his paintings, but also stories from his life.
And this is an ensemble piece, too.
Yes, this is the closing piece in the program for seven dancers.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. premiere of Christopher Bruce's Shadows is also, would we call it a showpiece?
Yes.
Part of the program?
Definitely. This is one of my favorite pieces on the program. I think it's going to be really powerful. Christopher Bruce is a choreographer who I've heard about for a long time. I've never had a chance to dance his works, unfortunately. And when I reached out to him, he was very happy and willing to grant me this piece, the rights to do this piece. And he doesn't shy away from real life stories. So his work sometimes has political elements to it. And the story is about a family, and they are a real life family in a real life situation in a struggle. So it's about the family dynamic and how the mother and the father and the son and the daughter all deal with that and deal with each other and what they do to solve the problem. It does kind of have a setting in a time and a place, but Christopher Bruce prefers to leave it a little more ambiguous, and we can kind of interpret it how we like. We can see what we want to put onto the piece from the audience. But it's a really special piece with music by Arvo Pärt.
Speaking of things we want to see, are we actually going to see you dance as part of this program, or are you just wearing the artistic director hat?
Yeah, that's just a bit much for this program. Maybe one day in the future.
All right. And the ballet continues for your work
with
the ballet?
Yes, I go back to work with the ballet in the first week of July.
What are you looking forward to this season?
Oh, we are doing a new works festival of 12 choreographers' works. So brand new works from 12 great artists, and we're going to premiere them all, I think, within the space of 1 week in April, which is going to be really exciting.
Well, we look forward to seeing this particular performance, and as I mentioned, the music of Arvo Pärt is featured in his Fratre for cello and piano, which we'll hear now as we say goodbye to James Sofranco and wish him well for his performances tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 8 o'clock, with a matinee added on Saturday as well. For more information, go to sfdanceworks.org. James, always a pleasure to have you in, and we might see you with as we discuss our next segment with the Sterngrove people. I understand the SF Ballet makes their regular appearance at Sterngrove Festival, of which you might be a part.
That's right. I hope to be there.
All right. Thanks, James. Music of Arvo Pärt, Fratre, for cello and piano, which will be the basis of the music that is being choreographed by Christopher Bruce and his work Shadows as part of SF Danceworks. Tonight, tomorrow, Saturday at 8, information at sfdanceworks.org. Well, as Sterngrove gears up for the opening of its 80th season of free concerts this Sunday with the R&B sensation Kool and the Gang, there's a new name at the head of the organization, Bob Fiedler. Bob's also new to the Bay Area, coming to us from Chicago, where he worked with a number of nonprofits and arts organizations, most recently as the executive director of the Chicago Human Rhythm Project, a nonprofit that presents dance performances and dance festivals, runs the American Rhythm Center Dance School, and provides weekly dance education to public school students. He's joined me in studio with Director of Programming Judy Zhang to talk about this year's lineup and the upcoming vision of Sterngrove. Welcome to you, Bob.
Thank you, David. So happy to be here.
And Judy, welcome you.
Hi.
Well, Judy, I imagine that with Bob being the new kid on the block, so to speak, that this Sterngrove season is largely a product of your work with the team of folks that are at Sterngrove for the past, I imagine, a year's worth of planning goes into each season at least.
Yes, it takes approximately a year to get the season together. I've been the director of programming for about the past 10, 11 years, and it's a long process. It's a puzzle piece to put it all together.
I'm sure. Well, let's drill down a little bit about the offerings this year. I mentioned Kool and the Gang start things off with a bang this Sunday.
Yes, and well, for this year, we decided to look towards the past a little bit and bring back some artists we've had in years past that were particularly great. So we do have Mavis Staples coming back, as well as the Malian duo Amadou and Mariam, War, and always our favorites, the San Francisco Symphony and San Francisco Ballet.
As we just heard, we might actually see James Sofranco as one of the dancers for SF Ballet. Always a great turnout for that. Now, the Sterngrove is so much more than just these Sunday concerts.
Yes, we have a series of education outreach activities as well during the weekdays. And actually, Bob just came back from one that we had today.
Tell us about that, Bob.
It was fantastic. We're doing work in the Boys and Girls Club downtown at Excelsior, and we're working with about 100 kids, teaching them different rhythms ranging from New Orleans to Latin to African. And it's really just an opportunity to expose kids to different culture and to share with them that we all have rhythm and that music is a universal language.
Well, that's right in your wheelhouse, too.
It is in my wheelhouse.
So, it's great. How else are you becoming involved in this season's Stern Grove?
Well, I'm just so happy to be here. As you mentioned, I was a veteran of the Chicago nonprofit art scene, and whenever I was interested in moving to the Bay Area and connected with the Stern Grove folks, the first time I went to visit, I just walked around the place and could not believe what a spectacular setting it is. And so with the season being right in front of us, really my job is to just, I get to sit back a little bit and learn from Judy and learn from the great folks that are putting this season into play. So I kind of have the luxury to just enjoy myself a little bit this year.
I'm sure you do. Now, I'm sure you visited the Bay Area before.
Oh, many, many times.
Okay.
It's been a second home for a long time.
So no stranger to the San Francisco Bay Area. Where did you end up settling now that you're here for good?
Well,
we hope for good. We'll see how the season goes.
I think
the board will be the judge of that.
No, I am here for good. I couldn't be happier. So I'm still settling on my permanent location. You know, I would very much like to be in the city, but we'll see how that goes. It's such a spectacular place.
Mm-hmm. Well, there must have been something in the interview process that struck the right chord to name you executive director. What sort of personal stamp do you see you're bringing to the organization?
Well, I think that there's just such an amazing foundation between having this long tradition and history, the spectacular setting itself. It's one of the most physically gorgeous places I could think of to see music between the redwoods and the eucalyptus and the fir trees. And then when I learned more about the artists that are often presented, I just said, oh my goodness, that's something that I want to be a part of. And I think that I really look forward to working with Judy and the rest of the board to continue to bring some of the best, most thrilling, vibrant musical performances to that setting. So it's really, I hope that while we're there, that the people who visit, they walk away and go, wow. That's what we're hoping for.
You can't help but go away from that place going, well, no matter whether the fog rolls in or not. You're really just, that's a very special place. Judy, how long ago was the stunning renovation that just makes this really more of a showcase venue than ever before?
Yeah, that happened in 2005. We went through a major renovation, and prior to that, the venue was also still very spectacular, but it's just a little more comfortable now for the audience and the artists that perform.
Mm-hmm. It's a pleasure to be there anytime, and this lineup is especially wonderful for Stern Grove 2017. Tell us a little bit more, though, about the Artists in Concert with Nature program, this new Interplay series.
Yes, we do have a couple of artists, local artists, who will be commissioned. We've commissioned them to present and play a brand new piece of music for our audience this summer that will be debuted at their performance. Kev Choice Ensemble's one of them. Ensemble is Ballet Folklorico de San Francisco. They're actually premiering two pieces, Stone Foxes, as well as Quinn DeVoe.
Nice. And more information about those programs are at the website, sterngrove.org, as well. For those that have not experienced Stern Grove, how do you suggest they experience it?
Well, they should come with a bunch of friends and family, bring a blanket, and make a day out of it. It's fun if you plan for it and prepare, bring layers, because you never know what the weather is going to be like.
San Francisco summer.
That's right. And just, you know, get there early and enjoy themselves. It's really a wonderful chance to connect with your family and friends and the people around you in the community.
Easy to get to as well by either public transportation or there's parking on site. Tell us a little bit about is there still the picnic table lottery that goes on for?
Yes, there's still that as well for the public. They just need to go up on our website and sign up.
What does that entail?
Just It's a lottery, meaning that you punch in your email address, and the week before the concert, we'll let you know whether or not you can have a spot on one of our picnic tables, which is a reserved area, so you don't have to get there as early as everyone else because it's first come, first serve seating. So you're guaranteed a couple seats to watch the show.
Nice way to do it, and some prime seats as well with a nice picnic table. So when do people start arriving for these 2 o'clock concerts? So if, for the newcomer, when should they start trekking out?
As early as they possibly can, because the earlier you get there, the better seat you get.
But in honesty, there's no bad seat in the house, even if you're up in the woods itself.
In the hillside, yes, which is how I experienced it growing up. I get there early at 7 o'clock in the morning, and on some occasions, there's some people out there at that time, which is very surprising. But you know, a couple hours before would be really great if you could just get there early and just make the day out of it and just enjoy the park setting.
Nice. Well, we look forward to Stern Grove always and your wonderful programming, and look forward to what Bob's going to be bringing to the table.
Thank you, David.
Bob Fiedler, Judy Tsang, thanks for coming in. We'll go out with some Cool in the Gang, which you can probably hear this tune, no doubt, this coming Sunday, opening up Stern Grove Festival 2017. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
What's not to love about a little Cool and the Gang, starting things off for Stern Grove Festival 2017. More information and ways to get on that picnic table lottery are at the website sterngrove.org. Well, Frame Line 41 is winding down this Sunday with a feature film called After Louis that stars Alan Cummings. I had the chance to catch up with programmer Harry Vaughn and with filmmaker Tom Gustafson, who directed tonight's feature. Hello Again, the musical. I caught up with them yesterday at the Frame Line offices. Here's that conversation. Harry Vaughn, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first time programmer for Frame Line.
Yeah, I know. It's been quite a trip in a really good way. This has been one of the most enthusiastic audiences I've ever seen. It's been really fun.
Well, you've been a programmer for several other film festivals. I'm wondering if there's any crossover. Do you maybe see something at another film festival that you can say to the submitter, well, maybe not so much for us, but you should consider submitting for some other?
Well, I can't say that at the time to the filmmaker, because if I'm wearing a different festival hat, I have to stay, you know, true to the festival that I'm working to. But I do keep internal notes about what I see. And I have kind of a little mental baggie of films that I hope to bring over from, you know, one festival to the next.
And speaking of the hats you wear as a programmer, what is your specialty? Is there a particular type of film that you're your forte?
Well, when I work 6 months of the year at Sundance, my forte is in documentary features. And then at Frameline, it's just about everything. It's shorts, narratives, features, all that.
So you also welcome audiences to the screenings with brief film announcements, which I heard you do today for an interesting documentary, 100 Men.
Yeah, I think it's funny. For about half the year, or at least half the festival preparation time, programming is a very antisocial profession in the sense that you're just hiding out in your home watching films on Vimeo links, not speaking to anybody. And then the second half during the festival is all about public speaking and talking with the filmmakers and making sure everyone's having a good time. So it's quite a juxtaposition.
What films are you particularly proud of that you were involved in the decision-making process that appeared in this festival?
Well, the cool thing about Frameline is it's really a group effort with everyone involved on the team. I am particularly proud about the fact that we got Whitney, Can I Be Me? From Nick Broomfield and Rudy Dolezal. That is one of the more intriguing documentaries I've seen on, you know, a very celebrated person in quite some time. Yeah. I think obviously Whitney is a gay icon, so that in and of itself is a draw. But I really appreciated how this film looked at her career from the lens of somebody who was manipulated and wronged by the music industry at a very young age based on her race and also based on questions of her sexual orientation. And I think that hasn't been brought up in a real official way yet, in a caring way. It's been gossipy about Whitney for so long, but there's dignity to this film and to its questions, and I think it's going to really intrigue people who see it.
And that's airing tonight at the Castro at 6:30. Tickets, I hope, are still available.
They are. It's at Rush right now, but I would urge anyone to try and check it out.
This is airing on Thursday, day 8 of the 11-day festival. Safe to say in the home stretch, but still some great screenings to come, including tonight's Hello Again, which I'll be talking with director Tom Gustafson shortly. What else are you looking forward to in the rest of the festival?
David France has a documentary called The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. And for those who don't know, David France is the Oscar-nominated director of How to Survive a Plague. And this is a really remarkable follow-up that looks at a Stonewall trans icon and her mysterious disappearance and death, and getting to the bottom of what really happened to her, but also who she was, a reminder of how remarkable her life was and how influential she was in the history of the queer movement.
Hmm. And of course, the closing night film featuring Alan Cumming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a phenomenal... I mean, it's ridiculous to say this is a phenomenal Alan Cumming's performance, because what isn't a phenomenal Alan Cumming's performance? But I do have to say personally that this is one of the most nuanced and impressive performances I've seen from this man's pretty illustrious career. And the film itself is a perfect closer for Frameline. It's a perfect film for gay festivals. It bridges a huge generational gap between gay men, the older generation that experienced the AIDS epidemic, and the younger generation, some of whom try to pretend like it never really happened. And so there's a big conversation about that divide in history. And I think that the filmmaker does an incredible job, and Alan Cummings really knocks it out of the park.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots more to come on Frameline between now and closing Sunday. That 7 o'clock film with Alan Cummings as after Louis is at 7 p.m., followed by the final party of Frameline 41 at the Oasis Dance Club. Well, I understand, on a more personal note, you were recently married and that you are the proud father of a corgi.
Yes, his name is Walter, and he is my everything. My husband, too, but Walter is my light.
But that you missed the CorgiCon in San Francisco while you were here.
I mean, frankly, I love the idea of the CorgiCon, but I would be terrified taking my corgi there because I don't know how you would find him. Also, corgis are, you know, at least mine is pretty wild. And once he goes running on a beach, it's hard to get him back.
Harry Vaughn, thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tom Gustafson, such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, among your many awards and recognitions is your 2008 film musical fantasy, Were the World Mine, being a New York Times critic pick. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
This is only the fourth off-Broadway musical to be adapted into a film. It takes its inspiration from the 1897 play La Ronde by Arthur Schnitzler, the play twice being produced for the screen, not as a musical, an Oscar-nominated version in 1950 and a 1964 version that starred Jane Fonda, also with the title of the film La Ronde. Did you find any inspiration in either of those incarnations to help you in your vision for this?
Yeah, I mean, definitely I went back to the original film. And, you know, that was part of kind of our production design book that we used as inspiration. I mean, it's a very different take. You know, Michael John's take when he created Hello Again, the musical for stage, he put it in 10 different time periods, and the original La Ronde is all one time period. So there's a difference there.
Well, let's start with that. Spanning 10 decades, quite a challenge for design on both the set and costume front. Were there different designers for the different eras, or did you just get one real superstar that could do it all?
No, we got one superstar, and that actually is what attracted my partner Corey, who adapted the Michael John's musical into the script. We were excited about taking the challenge of okay, let's do an independent film, and then let's try to do 10 different time periods. That was very exciting to us.
Well, for those unfamiliar with the plot, why don't you get us on board with a basic synopsis of what Hello Again's about?
Yes, it's basically 10 chapters. That are 10 love affairs over 10 time periods. So, for example, the first one is a soldier and a prostitute, and then the soldier carries over to the next chapter, and he's with a nurse, and then it becomes, you know, a circular kind of structure.
Your background includes lots of casting for extras for various projects. I suppose that came in handy for this project. Let's just talk about a couple of the amazing stars you got for this. The extraordinarily versatile Audra McDonald, who just starred and stunned us all as Madame Garderobe in the live version of Beauty and the Beast. Operatic singer Mother Abbess in the 2013 Sound of Music Live. I know her from my work with Mike Nichols on 2001's Wit. And then you have the amazingly wonderful Martha Plimpton, who's done Grey's Anatomy, Raising Hope, the film version of Sondheim's Company, the recent series The Real O'Neills, the absolutely adorable Cheyenne Jackson, super singing voice, and then his film and movie credits and TV, American Horror Story, also The Real O'Neills. And he was also in Behind the Candelabra, the Steven Soderbergh film about Liberace that starred Michael Douglas. Quite a catch with just those three.
Yeah, thanks. You know, when we started the project, you know, Michael John and Audra have obviously worked together in many, many ways. And she was the first person that we got attached to the project, and that was, you know, a great kind of leaping off point to attract other people. And then with Martha Plimpton's character in the original production, that role was played by a male actor, and we decided to kind of switch that up a little bit, which I think is what attracted Martha to the role as well.
And then how did the other cast come together, from projects that you've worked with them on or that you've seen in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of a long, kind of a puzzle that we had to put together. The way that we shot this film was not kind of the normal, you know, X amount of days straight through. We actually kind of had to do segments. And because every actor appears with, you know, two other actors, it becomes a real puzzle piece. So it was really step by step. As soon as we had one, we'd start thinking, okay, who would make a great, co-star with that person? And it just, you know, became a process. But it really was, you know, Michael John's music that got a lot of people interested and excited about, you know, the uniqueness of this piece, which attracted them to it.
Speaking of the shooting schedule and the puzzle pieces being put together, where was it shot?
We shot the whole thing in New York City. Most of it up in Upper Manhattan, and then we actually had a couple locations kind of in the outer boroughs, and we actually built a set for one of the chapters.
Surprises along the way?
Many. I mean, there always are on independent film. We also did all the music, all the singing is live, which was, if you know Michael John Lacuse's music, I mean, it's very difficult. And, every actor did all of their singing live, which was pretty intense and scary and good.
So what happens in post-production? Is that cleaned up somewhat, or are they singing again to their what's happening? Or is everything you record live, is that what ends up in the film as well?
Yeah, almost. I'd say like 90%, maybe even 95% of the singing that's in the movie is the live recording. There's some stuff that, you know, you have to go in and obviously sweeten because of room tone or, you know, the various things. But, you know, unless it was, you know, a montage, like, for example, there's a montage in one of the chapters where obviously it didn't make sense for them to sing live in every single shot, so that we use some of the studio recording there. But yeah, like 95% is all live on set singing.
Well, I'm sure you're going to have an amazing audience for this Thursday tonight at the Castro. Tickets available still through frameline.org, I believe. If not, they're already at Rush, and you'll have to get them at the Castro, but I would urge you to get them as soon as you can. Fantastic. I can't wait to see what you've done with this musical. What else is on your books after Hello Again? I mean, this is put to bed. It's hopefully going to have a lovely life. What's next for you?
And it's not put to bed quite yet. I mean, it's the journey of a indie filmmaker. I think it's going to be a long road to finally move on. But we definitely have. We have a couple other musicals that we're developing, as well as some historical pieces. So we have a lot on our plate. We're also trying to, Corey and I are trying to develop some TV ideas as well.
Well, keep in touch, and we'll have you back when you're in San Francisco again.
Great. Thanks so much.
Director Tom Gustafson. Hello Again screens tonight at the Castro Theater at 9:30. Quite a stellar cast. Here's Audra McDonald, speaking of the stellar cast, singing one of the famous tunes from the musical Beyond the Moon, from Hello Again. Audra McDonald singing Beyond the Moon from the musical movie Hello Again, being screened tonight at 9:30 as part of Frameline 41. Frameline.org for more information of the many screenings happening between now and the closing film on Sunday evening. Closing party as well at the Oasis. Check it out. Frameline.org. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe. Happy to be with you on this Thursday, June 22nd, and happy to welcome a couple of my guests. Next, one regular contributor, Peter Robinson, who has the pleasure of talking with Philippa Kelly, Shakespeare scholar and dramaturg for Cal Shakes. Welcome to you, Philippa and Peter.
Hi, David. Yes, good to be here.
And I'll turn things over to you. Philippa, first of all, I didn't even realize your wonderful spouse, Paul Drescher, is such a great friend and a friend of KLW. I'm happy to find that connection there.
Well, I'm happy to tell it to you.
Right. Here's Peter.
Yeah, and I think Philippa, will, once she speaks, we will recognize her voice, because if you have been down to the Cow Shakes at the beginning, come these wonderful pre-theater talks, which takes you through the story, introduces you to the cast, and really helps in interpreting what we're about to see. So she is a dramaturge. She's also the dramaturge consultant up at Ashland for the Oregon Shakespeare. And this summer, she's also been teaching to, I think, at least 500 students down in Santa Cruz, introducing Shakespeare from day one till the very end of the course. So, again, it's a real pleasure to have you with us, Philippa. Welcome. And let's start with telling us, what does a dramaturge do?
Well, that's an ever more complicated question as our society shifts and changes. In fact, this very day, in the next couple of days, Peter, there is the annual meeting of the Literary Dramaturgs and Managers of the Americas, Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas, in Berkeley. So I'm attending that and hosting a panel and listening to many presentations about dramaturgs and our shifting role. But the idea of the dramaturg really began in 18th century Germany, the idea of conserving texts, particularly Shakespeare, so that the words wouldn't get abused and bowdlerized and whatever. And over time, particularly over the last couple of decades, dramaturgy has become not just about seeing what the original interpretation of the words was, but also about understanding context in which we place the plays, giving information to the actors and the crew and the director, of course, that might help to frame the production and bring it to life in new ways. And then, of course, at Cal Shakes, I do a lot of the audience enrichment activities, talkbacks and things.
So you're the link between the actors, the director, and then eventually the audience, bringing everything together from words to staging as well, to some extent?
Well, I would say I'm a link, but mm-hmm. I often find that designers are some of the best dramaturgs, because they have to know knowing the set and the costumes, they have to know the world of the production thoroughly.
Now, just recently, the closing play up at Ashland is Merry Wives of Windsor. You've been behind the scenes on that one. So let's talk a little bit about the setting. I think you told me it was set in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And there's actually a female Falstaff. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, the fabulous Katie Vogt, who really is, she's an amazing actress. She's been there for many years now. And the festival really wanted, well, director Dawn Williams, but the festival behind her really wanted to present this opportunity to the audiences up there.
And the story, which is set originally in Windsor, in fact, it's the only Shakespearean play set in an English village. When we move it to the 1980s, what are the Merry Wives like? What do they wear? How do they present themselves?
The Merry Wives are sort of, they're the merchant class. It was Shakespeare's only play set in his contemporary London. And it's interesting that this merchant class is not so different from our Nordstrom and Saks Fifth Avenue shoppers. Mm-hmm. Today. people for whom money has meant personal transformation.
And I'm right in saying the whole play is in prose, so again, that makes for dialogue being, I'm going to think, more digestible for everyday audiences.
Well, it's interesting. When Shakespeare wrote in poetry, particularly end rhyme, that actually made the lines much more easy for the actors to memorise. I think what the prose does with this particular play is that it's a verbal equivalent of actions, you know, somebody popping out from behind a sofa and banging you on the head. That's what words do in this particular play via the flexibility of prose.
And, of course, it is a play of physical comedy, and we have a couple of scenes. I mean, I think Falstaff at one point is put in a laundry basket and dropped in a lake or a pool or a river.
Well, we don't see the water in our production, but we see him after he's had his drubbing, so we see the results.
And, you know, Falstaff also is involved in disguise, and costume does play a certain role. How do we handle that up in Ashland?
So the costume, there's sort of pantomime costuming. Interestingly, I love the way it's costumed, and it reminds me that in Shakespeare's theatre, costume was actually the most expensive budget item for his actors. We hear a lot of 1980s musical numbers that many of the audience will hark back to.
So music, you know, as it does in pantomime, plays a part. And I mean, I know it's irrelevant to the Bard to say this, but I've often thought an updated version of Merry Wives could be the Real Housewives of Los Angeles. and in fact, it is a love story with a twist. I think that's the best way to describe the basic storyline in this.
Well, when it was actually made, the kind of story is that Queen Elizabeth loved Falstaff in the early plays so much that she then commissioned Shakespeare to write a play about Falstaff being in love. Mm-hmm. I contend that Falstaff is actually not very interested in being sexy. He's interested in getting one of these wives to finance comfortably the last part of his career.
So it's a kind of love for sale, if you put it like that.
Knighthood for sale.
Knighthood's for sale. And believe me, in the current House of Lords, we've still got a few of those baronetcies who paid their way into Tony Blair's world. But let's go back to the Merry Wives. If you're sitting in the audience when the curtain or no curtain rises, what does the set actually look like?
Well, the set is very the one word to describe it is vivid, mm-hmm. and the costumes are really just there's a sort of a lovely pantomime feel. So you feel like you are removed into a world of fantasy, but in which your own foibles will become very much recognized.
Mm-hmm. And I know as a dramaturge, you know, that words become important. There is that curious reference to Dickens in this play. And I'm thinking people would say, but Charles Dickens was never alive in 1597 when the play was written. So how do we account for the use of the word Dickens?
Funny you should ask that. It's actually a synonym for Satan. So some people, I think, view Falstaff as a kind of a satanic figure of deception. But he's essentially not immoral. He's more amoral. I mean, in a way, he's a less successful Bernie Madoff.
That's right. I think for him, for all sorts of intrigue. And the other expression I always smile is It's a line from a Pistol, if I remember, the world's my oyster, which in fact is turned around because Pistol's using it in a very different context to how we use it today.
Yeah, and in fact, well, there are so many malapropisms in this play, and if anybody gets to see it, which I hope you will, just remember that words are bashing up against each other, just in the same way that actions in Farce do. That's the really clever thing about Merry Wives.
So now we're going to shift the action. We're moving from Ashland down here to Orinda, to Cowshakes. And Philippa, you've been involved in the upcoming production of The Glass Menagerie, Tennessee Williams. So how is that going?
Well, I know I'm supposed to say this, but actually it's true. Absolutely fantastic.
There we go.
The director, Lisa Portes, who actually won the Zelda Fishandler Award for directing in 2016, which is a very prestigious award, she's heading this ship. And we've got Karen Aldridge, Raphael Jordan, Sean San Jose, and Phoebe Fico as the cast of Glass Menagerie. And it's a very differently imagined world, the Wingfield world.
And just a little about the characters, because I think if I looked briefly at that cast list, it's a very multi-ethnic cast list. So we've moved a little from what I might call the old South of Tennessee Williams to something which speaks to today. Is that a good interpretation or not?
I think that's spot on. But then the question is, we often get, why do you do that? What does it add to the play? And people sometimes worry that it takes away. But in fact, what I think is really fantastic about this imagination or new imagining of the play is that we want our audience to listen in new ways, and we want people on stage, of course, to reflect the ethnic diversity of the people in the stalls, but we want this new casting and staging to illuminate Williams's play through the prism of a different cultural iteration or landscape. Lisa's basic idea is she wants to show these four people displaced against an American landscape, but a different one from what Williams had in the 1940s. Just bear in mind that this play was Williams' first really successful play. Gore Vidal once said about Williams that he could not possess his life until he had written it. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually the story of Williams's early life as imagined through the prism in 2017, although we keep the time and setting the same, but as imagined in a world where African-American Amanda Wingfield looks back at her cotillion days in the early 1900s, and there was a small set of African-American people who'd been gifted land in the late 19th century after being slaves, who actually had money and who were able to and wanted to reproduce within their own community the dignity and hope and all those things that were invested in cotillion balls and the idea of being a debutante in society and the path that might take you and the doors that might be open for you.
So Amanda stays true to the Tennessee Williams character in the sense it's reflection, it's memory, it's catching up, and it's imagination. And I think this sounds to me as though it's bringing all three of these elements together.
Yes, and you know, one thing I said a couple of times to Lisa, and we both really sort of keep this idea in our minds, is that Amanda has a sort of a childlike wish to, a childlike hope that is never destroyed by the realities of her experience. So it's that hope that keeps her pushing and pressing up against the future, trying to shape it. And I think we as audience members, if we look at that, we can see that in various forms in our own lives. We might have lost that capacity years ago, or we might still have it, but we recognize it in ourselves, even if for ourselves it's in rubble.
So this is the second play in the current cycle. That's Glass Menagerie. It's the outdoor theater at Cowshakes, which is just a beautiful setting. Mm. And I think you were telling me that the way the play opens is bringing the furniture for the set onto the stage.
Yes, Annie Smart, a fabulous set designer and actually costume designer, but she's usually used for set, designed a set that as the memory rolls on, the pieces of the set are brought before the audience by the actors.
And just to finish up, beyond Shakespeare, the theatre, you've actually been teaching down in Santa Cruz. You've had, what, 500 students? Is that what I heard?
Yes, and it's called Shakespeare for Everyone. It's just closed. And that was quite an experience, leading all those people through a 10-play course over the series of 10 weeks.
Good. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We have a wonderful season here at Cal Shakes to look forward to. We've been talking to Philippa Kelly, the dramaturge, and also up in Ashland, the Merry Wives of Windsor. And what is this tune you've suggested?
An un-Shakespearean tune, but you'll hear it if you go up to OSF. I want to dance with somebody.
Here's your chance. Let's go.
With music of Whitney Houston, whose biopic is actually featured tonight at 6:30 as part of the Frameline Film Festival. A very revealing, intimate portrait of a very troubled life of Whitney Houston tonight at 6:30 at Frameline. And hear this tune up at Oregon Shakes. Cal Shakes, the Glass Menagerie, runs through July 30th. Information at calshakes.org. I want to dance with somebody who loves me, the great Whitney Houston. Amazing voice. Well, on a different note, as you hear in the background, the San Francisco Symphony presents quite a series of concerts over these next several days. MTT and the Symphony performs a program framed by dynamic dancers and illuminating imagery in this one-of-a-kind multi-sensory experience. Tomorrow at 7:30, Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2 o'clock, you'll hear Antal's Jazz Symphony, which you're hearing in the background, inspired by jazz, Latin American music, and French modernism, as well as the MTT premiere, the West Coast premiere of MTT's own song cycle, Four Preludes on Playthings of the Wind. You'll see some choreography and direction by James Darrow, who was talking with Sarah Cahill this past Sunday as part of Revolutions Per Minute, that conversation archived at our website, kalw.org. Michael Tilson Thomas conducting. Miasha Brugger Guzman is a soprano featured from the San Francisco Symphony. There's also being Michaela Bennett as vocalist, Kara Duggan, Nadia Tichman on violin, as well as dancers and choreography tomorrow evening at 7:30, Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2 p.m. That's Open Air for this Thursday, June 22nd. I'm David Latulippe. Thanks for listening. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can send me a show suggestion, David@kalw.org. Thanks for listening.